so much for taking the time to download and listen to this week's show. If you like what we do, please give the show a like and a share. And if you love what we do, you know, please consider becoming a patron. It really helps us to develop and bring more content for yourselves and also for the movement in general. This week's show is an absolute cracker. It was with Kohai Saito, a Japanese philosopher and an associate professor at the University of Tokyo. Kohai works on ecology and political economy from a Marxist perspective, and his books include Karl Marx Eco-Socialism, Capital in the Anthropocene, Marx in the Anthropocene Towards the Idea of Degrowth Communism, and his latest book, Slow Down, the Degrowth Manifesto. For many people that have been following the show, we've been covering degrowth for a long time now, and I believe that Kohai is a really crucial addition to the episodes that we've done before, and his idea around degrowth communism has really sort of made waves, not without criticism. There's a little bit of infighting at the moment, especially online, which isn't great to see, but I completely understand it. I mean, theories need to be thrashed out. You need to be challenged. My personal hope is that we can somehow get some sort of agreements and cohesion about actually putting these theories into work. Some of the topics on the show are Kohai's background as a Marxist scholar, which is immense, Marxism in Japan, his theory around a more environmental Karl Marx, which he found in Marx's later writings, criticism of his work, we discussed that, the environment movement as a whole, and what actions we should be taking, all of us. I found his conversation, I found him really warm, very genuine. He did us a solid, really, because in Japan, it was like really late at night because obviously the time difference, and he was a great guest. I never felt like he was trying to get off from the show at all. A real gentleman, really enjoyed the conversation, and I hope you do too. So on with the show. Kohai, a warm welcome to the show, mate.
Hi, thank you for the invitation.
Oh, thank you so much for coming on. For people that don't know, it's about 10 o'clock in Japan, so I really appreciate yeah. your time, pal. Okay, it's great to have you on. A little bit about yourself, please.
So I'm a Marxist scholar in Japan teaching at the University of Tokyo. So basically, my approach is about reinterpreting Karl Marx's philosophy in the age of the Anthropocene, because he was often criticized for advocating kind of the absolute domination of nature. So he is basically an ecological thinker. I argue, in contrast, that he was clearly an ecological thinker, and he also provides a clear, more sustainable vision of post-capitalism, which we actually really direly need. So this is a very great source of inspiration that, yeah, I'm really looking forward to discussing this issue with you tonight.
Brilliant. And as right. you said there, you are a bona fide scholar of Karl Marx. Now, at some point, I'm guessing that you were probably more class conscious than climate conscious. So was the a moment, or is it more of an evolution of your thinking that made you decide that actually, you know, the environment and the climate crisis is so big and so all encompassing that you really need to sort of start thinking about it and bringing it into your analysis?
Yeah, I entered the college in 2005, and that was like the time in Japan when more and more precarious jobs and the temporary precarious workers were increasing. And I was struck by the fact that many people are working so hard, but they are suffering from the constant threat of losing jobs and the precarity and the poverty and so on. And that was actually confirmed in the middle of the economic crisis of 2008. So that was a moment when I really decided to pursue my career as a Marxist scholar. And then, yeah, as you said, it was more like a traditional issue of class inequality and exploitation of workers and so on. But in order to pursue my career, I went to Germany. I went to Berlin to study Marx there. But then right after moving to Berlin, there was a huge earthquake in Japan, 2011. And then that yeah. was followed by a very disastrous nuclear explosion mm-hmm. in Fukushima. So I was actually very, very shocked, obviously. But by the fact that I didn't really pay attention to the issue of relationship between human and nature and ecological questions, and I was wondering how Marx would have responded to this kind of issue, because I was also, in a sense, traditional Marxist, because I was also endorsing a kind of vision of emancipatory potential of technological development and so on. Well, how do we explain this nuclear energy? It was supposed to, kind of count, it was supposed to count as a kind of development productive forces, but it's actually really destroying the environment and people's lives and so on. So I started to questioning Marx's vision of emancipation based on the so kind of development of productive forces. So this is the moment when I paying atten started to paying attention to the relationship between humans, nature, and technology. So this was a very important moment for me, because then I started actually looking at Marx's notebooks, because I was in Berlin, and there was an academy called Berlin Brandenburgische Akademie, that this new complete works of Marx and Engels is actually edited. It's still project going on there. And then I was lucky enough to join the project. And then there, I actually happened to find that Marx left a number of notebooks on natural sciences. He didn't publish it because it was supposed to be preparation for writing his critique of political economy, that's Capital. But then while I was looking at them, I realized that he was actually really concerned about, for example, the issue of soil exhaustion, excessive deforestation, and that kind of issue of sustainability came up a lot in his notebooks, not necessarily in his published writings. So this is really a new for me, and then I built on my thesis of ecological socialism based on what I discovered in his notebooks.
Yeah, and we'll definitely get into your ideas and your books. But just before we do, I just want to sort of ask you, so your books sold really well in Japan. And they were like bestsellers. And obviously in the West here, when we think about Marxism, Japan's not necessarily a country that springs to mind as a hotbed of Marxism or communism. Was it a surprise for yourself that your book took off, or is there actually something there in Japan that we just weren't aware of in Europe?
Oh yeah. Of course, it's a big surprise that my book actually sold more than 500,000 copies, because my book about
Whoa.
communism in the age of ecological crisis sounds quite crazy, right? Because everyone thinks, of course, in Japan too, that Marx is already outdated and proved wrong after the collapse of Soviet Union and so on. However, it's interesting to actually say that actually in Japan, Japanese society is very, very conservative, but at the same time, Marx is quite widely read before the collapse of Soviet Union. So many Department of Economics used to be occupied by Marxian economists. So even like today's politicians, like ruling class elite, establishment people, especially now the age of 50s and 60s, have all some kind of experience with Marxism. So in as a kind of the intellectual mind, they have some openness to Marxism. But that doesn't mean that they are passionate about
No.
transforming capitalism, right? So there's some kind of interesting
I'm curious,
historical,
but
uniqueness, where it kind of prepared the reception of my book. But obviously, again, in that doesn't mean the guarantee of the success of my book. I think it was largely due to the fact that my book, Slow Down, which is now available in English too, Slow Down came out in the middle of pandemic, when the issue of ecological crisis as well as economic inequality under capitalism, especially due to the neoliberal reforms, became quite acute. So I think people started looking really for alternatives in order to protect their own lives from the pandemic and so on.
Yeah, definitely. So now coming to some of the ideas in your book, I'm interested to know what made you decide that degrowth was the theory for you? Because obviously, when you're talking about planetary boundaries, which you do in your book, and maybe you can describe to the audience just how many we're exceeding, just to give a bit of background of the trouble we're in. I often think when people talk about planetary boundaries, they look the one that springs to mind most obvious to me, like donut economics. And there is others as well. But degrowth, you've obviously taken on degrowth. What is it specifically about degrowth that you liked and that you decided to bring into your analysis?
Oh yeah, so I explained that I discovered Marxian vision of eco-socialism in Germany. So that was a part of my dissertation, which is published as Karl Marx Eco-Socialism. But at the time, in my first book, I never mentioned degrowth. I simply said capitalism is unsustainable. It seriously distorts the relationship between humans and nature, creates a kind of metabolic rift, and that is irreparable under capitalism. So Marx said that we need to have a very different vision of mode of production, which he thinks that will be more sustainable. So I called it eco-socialism. But I must say that at the time I was still too optimistic in a sense, and I was also kind of endorsing still a kind of productivism. In the sense that even after the nuclear disaster in Fukushima, I still believed that after the transcendence of capitalism, if it's possible, if something like that happens, socialism or can somehow more rationally regulate the metabolic interaction between human and nature. And then in order to do this, they can also the socialism can also develop new technologies, more sustainable technologies in a more efficient manner. So socialism can plan, it doesn't necessarily seek after only profit, but it can also care about environment and equality. So I thought that under that kind of new conditions of production, it is possible to have more kind of economic growth under eco-socialism. My assumption was basically it is possible to decouple the economic growth from resource and energy usage. For example, if we look at the history in the past, as the GDP grows, we also produced more carbon dioxide. But today, if we invest in renewable energies or electric vehicles, we often say that it is possible to decouple. We can still continue to grow our economy by selling more cars and installing new solar panels and wind turbines, but without necessarily increasing the emission of carbon dioxide. So this is really decoupling compared to the past where we produced more cars, but it was always accompanied by more usage of fossil fuels and so on. So I was actually still at the time, 5, 6 years ago, believing in that kind of possibility of decoupling economic growth from environmental impact. So at the time, I also add that I was endorsing the Green New Deal, which is your
Yeah,
topic. And
that's us,
I
yeah.
thought that, in order to overcome the precariousness and then low wages of Japanese workers. I thought it is necessary to make this kind of green transition based on Green New Deal kind of policy so that it creates more jobs, more higher salaries, and then it can all kind of, make a more sustainable just transition. But I really changed my view around 2017 or a little bit later, 18 and 19, when people like Greta Thunberg, like a younger generation than I am, started to do more like a climate justice movement, right? And then, for example, in one speech, Greta Thunberg said that the people, older people, are still believing in the kind of the fairy tale of endless, infinite economic growth and that kind of thing, she said. And I actually came to realize that this is the same structure between Tokyo and Fukushima, you know, the center of the capitalism, like Tokyo, are actually becoming more and more affluent based on the exploitation of the countryside, like Fukushima. And the same structure can emerge on the global scale, like Japan or UK or the US can invest with or can grow with green technology, but at the cost of the global south, right? So this is a very simple story, but it's quite actually possible. So then I started rethinking about this relationship about the decoupling and also the new technologies, how are they feasible and so on. And then really gradually shifting towards degrowth. But then I had, again, this kind of crisis. Then how is it compatible with Marx's idea of eco-socialism? Degrowth is something that is beyond the imagination of Marxism. And then we have often, like today, we have a lot of discussion about how it is compatible or incompatible. Should working class endorse the idea of degrowth or green growth? And that kind of debate was very important for me 4 years ago and so on. And then one of my answer is elaborated in the book Slow Down.
And I think you've highlighted an important point there in regards to what a particular title of a theory it can mean different things to different people. So just as you mentioned there about Green New Deal, so when most people think about the Green New Deal, I think they think about the US version, the sort of a massive investment into jobs and electrifying everything and all that. And that is obviously a conversation, but in the UK, a Green New Deal is still quite an open space. So I think the reason, like, for example, we've chosen our name as the Green New Deal is because green is just a universal for the environment. And then you've just got like New Deal, which is quite a generic, quite a broad term. So we just feel that it's a space that's still yet to be filled. But again, it's the same with
More
degrowth
of
as
a
well.
political vacuum, I think, in the UK these
But
yeah.
at the moment, it's nothing in it. There used to be a little bit of something in it. Now there's nothing in it. Yeah, we've got to start again
just
over
us two. Dear.
it. But again, it's with degrowth, isn't it? There is people that adhere to degrowth, call themselves degrowth scholars. There is maybe a foundation of what they agree with, but there's still conversations regarding, different parts of it that's still open to discussion. Is that about right?
And then so I actually, you know, for me, there are a lot of discussions on degrowth already, right? So why do Marxists actually say have to say something about degrowth? I mean, and actually some people believe that it's not really important to connect Marx and degrowth because what Marx says really doesn't matter to degrowth. I mean, I understand that point, but at the same time, it's true that for some people, what Marx said matter. Living in the country near China, in China, for example, it really matters what Marx said. But also in other countries, you know, we have a lot of unionist, working class people, and then we need to make a concrete strategy and tactics for working class, right? And in order to imagine a new tactics and strategy, it's really helpful to refer to what Marx actually said because his vision and his critique of post-capitalism and his critique of capitalism is quite useful in order to build up a new movement and so on. And so my struggle was actually, so degrowth for me was very convincing, but at the same time, the existing working class movements are still endorsing a kind of vision with more green growth. And so how would Marx analyze this tension? That was my question. Actually, it's too naive to believe that Marx simply said, okay, once we overcome capitalism, all those capitalist technologies will be somehow sustainable and emancipatory and so on, right? So it's reasonable to assume that Marx had some other aspect, especially in his later years. So I started looking at other materials that he didn't necessarily publish. The one was notebooks on natural sciences. But at the same time, he studied quite intensively pre-capitalist and non-Western societies. Especially he studied Russian agricultural communes quite intensively. So my question was, why Marx was studying natural science and pre-capitalist societies at the same time in order to finish volume 2 and 3 of Capital? So all those things doesn't make sense, right? If he was supposed to complete volume 2 and 3 of Capital, he should have studied actually political economy or the recent development of capitalism in Europe or in the US. Mm-hmm. But he didn't. He did this to some point, but he spent more time and energy on studying new topics like natural sciences and pre-capitalist society. Why? So I started reading his notebooks on Russia, Ireland, and other societies. And I came to realize, actually, this seemingly unrelated topics of natural sciences and the pre-capitalist societies are actually connected. Different societies, like pre-capitalist or non-Western societies, have different way of interacting with nature because they have different system of property, different ways of regulation, law, and different ways of relating to each other. So that's also have a significant impact on how we organize our relationship with the environment, right? So he then studied actually Germanic communes or Russian agricultural communes, and he came to realize that these societies actually consciously regulated in a way that the society doesn't grow. Even if they have a potentiality of growing more, they didn't do it because often the growth could lead to economic inequality and the concentration of power. So those society actually consciously regulated their production for the sake of guaranteeing equality and freedom of people. But that also created a more sustainable condition of metabolic interaction. It's very interesting how Marx came to realize that those equal pre-capitalist societies are also more sustainable because those societies did not pursue economic growth as the first principle of social production. But capitalism is radically different. Right? Capitalism is about profit, economic growth, and so that's really created a very different dynamics, which however had a significant impact on our metabolic interaction with nature, and it's actually destroyed. So Marx actually came to advocate to make the long story very short, actually he came to endorse that the steady state economy that was actually existent in pre-capitalist society, it's something that those Western capitalist countries need to learn in order to establish a more sustainable society after capitalism. So that's what Marx actually said in his last letters to Russian revolutionary Vera Zasulich. He said, the Western societies have to go back to the higher stage of non-capitalist model production so that those Western societies can overcome the crisis of capitalism. So it's very different from what we usually associate with Marx's vision of socialism. It's usually like a, you know, very productivist, techno-fetish kind of view. Yeah, but he had actually more focusing on kind of the stability of society and the equality and the sustainability.
Yeah, I suppose kind of like there is a vision of post-capitalism which kind of takes the productive forces of capitalism and just makes it better for everyone, as opposed to going, actually, this whole process needs to be broken down and kind of started again without the idea of having to increasingly do more things and be more productive at the heart of it. You mentioned earlier on this term metabolic rift, and you know Marx is talks about metabolism quite a lot in his kind of theory and practice. So could you kind of explain a bit more about this metabolic rift idea that you write a lot about in Marx and the Anthropocene as well?
So the metabolism, the concept of Stoffwechsel in German, is basically that humans have to work upon nature, mediated by labor, in order to live, right? We cannot live by nothing. So we have to work upon land, and we have to extract resources, and we have to produce various products by working on our environment. But the way how we actually concretely organize this metabolic interaction between human and nature is radically different in each society, especially in the each mode of production. And capitalism has a very unique way of organizing this metabolism, because capitalism has the primacy, or the primary objective, which is capital's infinite growth and accumulation. And so the problem becomes the metabolism in society. So Marx actually distinguishes two kinds of metabolism. It's a metabolism in nature, which exists independently of humans, the soil, or air, and many things happen in nature without human intervention, right? That's a metabolism in nature. But metabolism in society is actually consisting of the circulation of commodity, money, and capital. So social metabolism under capitalism accelerates constantly, because capitalism try to shorten the circuit time, but at the same time, social metabolism continues to expand under capitalism. It really today subsumes the entire planet, which is why we call it the Anthropocene, right? But the problem is metabolism of nature, or natural metabolism, remains relatively constant over the time of history. So while social metabolism constantly becomes faster and bigger, natural metabolism cannot catch up with this tempo of capitalism. So what happens is actually the two kinds of metabolism, they actually connect to each other, because the circulation and production of a commodity actually do not take place without those resources and energy produced under the process of natural metabolism. But however, two logics of metabolism, natural and social, becomes quite sort of dissociated with each other. And in the end, Marx actually warns that under capitalism, there will be inevitably irreparable rift between the natural and social metabolism. And it is irreparable, because capitalism constantly, or must continue with the intervention of newer technologies. It try to increase efficiency, and it try to solve, or it try to decouple. They are not sufficient, because they are still used for the sake of producing more and producing faster. So it often ends up using more resources and energies. And that's why Marx says we really need to reorganize the entire metabolic process in a way that we don't necessarily focus simply on growth and profit. And this is why this idea of degrowth, which is basically, often people misunderstand, degrowth is not about going back to nature, going back to, life without technology. Marx says it's higher stage of pre-capitalist society. So he actually emphasizes that we have to use all that, whatever technologies that are necessary to increase our efficiency and so on. But we have to use them not for the sake of making more surplus value or profit, but for the sake of more creating equal and sustainable relationship among humans, but also with nature. And this is a very fundamental idea for degrowth communism.
Because I suppose to that point, actually, going back to that pre-capitalist place isn't about going back there without the technologies we have for, medicines and various other kind of, ways that society has improved over time. It's actually about going back to there in terms of the societal relationships we have. It's not about the stuff that we
Exactly.
have.
So, I mean, when I talk about degrowth communism, based on Marx's later writings, and he talks about those Russian agricultural communes, but he never says we should simply live like Russians, right? He rather says we have to combine both, and we have to mutually learn from each other. It's not simply, hey, Russians, look at our capitalism. It's much better, even though we have problems, but we're going to overcome with socialism. So let's just follow this path together. No, he says he really abandoned that kind of Eurocentric idea in his later years, and then emphasizes rather to learn from those non-Western societies. But that doesn't mean that simply going back today, we can, for example, say we have to learn from indigenous people and non-Western cultures. Mm-hmm. And we do these kind of things, right? But that doesn't mean that we abandon iPhones or the, you know, those technologies. And we also, I also do not say that we don't need electric vehicles. We should just live by bicycles. No, I don't say that. We need electric vehicles and we need renewable energies, because otherwise decarbonization is obviously impossible.
Yeah.
But at the same time, what the growth actually calls for is simply using those electric vehicles, not for the sake of producing profit. So that means that we should also limit or even reduce the number of the cars and the size of the cars, because in the global north, there are too many cars and those cars are often too big. So once we actually focus on the sustainability and the equality and justice, we can, of course, use those technologies because it's higher stage, but we also can establish more different kind of relationship with technologies and with nature. And so that's my point.
Yeah, and of all the degrowthers that we've had on the show, Kohei, one that's really advocated or really promoted the idea of where the working class fit into this theory is Jason Hickel, who I know that you know. And his episode, when we put it out, was actually titled Degrowth Means Power for the Working Class. So I'm just wondering, in regards to your own analysis, you know, where do you situate or where do you situate the working class? But also, if you had a message for the working class, yeah, because at the moment, it's kind of being degrowth. The stick that they beat degrowth with is, oh, it's going to affect, it's going to make working class poorer, it's going to make working. But if you had a message for the working class, what would you say in regards to where degrowth is situated in their day-to-day lives?
Yes, I think all the people in the global north must learn from the global south. And we also have to reflect upon how our affluence in the global north is often based on the suffering and the poverty of the many people in the global south and the destruction of the environment in the global south. So what happened in the 20th century is actually the, you know, the revolution, socialist revolution didn't happen in many Western countries and Japan and other countries too. But that was because working class people had some kind of class compromise with capitalist class. But that, of course, kind of realized a better life, and you know, it really created some kind of possibility for achieving middle class affluent life in the people in the global north. But that was actually simply shifting the problem of exploitation somewhere else. So that's what Marx Bissen and Ulrich Plant, the German sociologist, now calls imperial mode of living. So our way of living in the global north is often associated with the suffering of other some other people in somewhere else. But I think that's something what we really have to overcome in the face of this kind of planetary crisis, because the problem that we are facing today is planetary. Even if the people or working class in the global north, in the UK or Japan, somehow we implement Green New Deal, the American one, and then we became super rich, and but we have better life, but without carbon emission. But if that was based on some kind of massive extraction of resources in the global south, and then if we monopolize all those resources, and then if the people in the global south have to continue to use fossil fuels somehow, then the planet will warm up in the end and we will be all dead, right? So I think this kind of way of achieving some kind of transition just for the sake of people or working class in the global north doesn't work anyway. I think it is very important to have a different vision of more sustainable and more just kind of transition. It's very important to learn from other people. I think we really need to have a different vision of transition, and I think degrowth is essential presupposition to for us to talk about new strategies in the 21st century. I think without that, any attempt of radical transformation of capitalism will simply repeat the same failure of ecological imperialism, colonization, and even the greater suffering of more and more people as the earth degrades under the climate crisis.
So some of the pushback of yourself, Kohei, that I've seen in regards to your work when it relates to Marx is, and I completely take your point, you know, we bring with us what we've learned, we bring with us what we know. And so it completely makes sense to me that you're a Marx scholar. And so you're going to bring what you know and what you love and what you're passionate about to any new idea. Now, one of the key ones that I've seen people sort of be horrified at, and I think it's because sometimes what Marx says, some of his ideas can be looked upon as a kind of a sacred cow, is the idea around historical materialism. So for a lot of Marxists, historical materialism is one of those golden eggs that he meant this and he never changed his mind, and this means that, and nobody should ever, ever question or touch that concept. Now, just because some of our listeners may not know what that is, could you give us a brief overview of what historical material is? And then maybe where you kind of took it on and maybe tweaked it, or maybe believe that Marx didn't necessarily see it as a sacred cow.
Yes, the historical materialism is often considered as a law of history, the historical development. Mm. And usually we have different model production, and the model production consists of two factors. One is relations of production and forces of production. And the model production is slave model production, feudal model production, capitalist model production, and then maybe there's a socialist or communist model production. And then each model production has some kind of relation of production. Like in capitalism, we have wage and capital. And in slavery, we have master and slave. So that's the relation of production. And the forces of production is basically consisting of technologies and, you know, how much we can produce and that kind of subjective capacity to produce something, and the objective conditions of production, which is machinery, division of labor, and manufacture, and so on, right? And then according to historical materialism, when there's a tendency in history that forces of production increase, and after a certain point, there is a tension, increasing tension between relations of production and forces of production. For example, in feudalism, there's, you know, growing market, and they try to produce more, but the feudalist relations sort of impede the further development. So there will be after one point, the bourgeois revolution, and that really explodes the relations of production, and then establishes the new model production that actually corresponds to the stage of forces of production. If we apply this argument to capitalism, if we continue to increase forces of production or productive forces, there will be one day that we have enough capacity for everyone to be rich. But capitalism, the wealth is monopolized by a few capitalists. So, right, like one day there will be a massive kind of social revolution and so on. But this vision is quite simplistic, and it's driven by the possibility of increasing productive forces. So often the socialists end up saying, okay, then first we have to focus on the more and more development of productive forces. And that's the kind of the ultimate reason of why so many socialists and Marxists end up naively endorsing any kind of technology, including nuclear power, right? But that's not valid anymore, because we know, like nuclear power, those technologies are actually not sustainable. Those technologies developed under capitalism are not necessarily emancipatory, because those technologies are developed for the sake of controlling workers, dominating workers, but also exploiting more from nature. So it simply creates a more and more efficient way of exploiting both from human and nature. And Marx actually came to realize this after he studied natural sciences. So in the 60s, he had some kind of personal crisis. He used to believe that, okay, with the development of technologies, we can have some kind of socialism, that everyone can have private jets or something like that. But in the end, he came to realize, shit, those technologies actually simply destroy the planet. So we can't really simply naively say, better the more the technology, the better the future. He abandoned that in the 60s or even 70s. It took a long time for him to actually abandon historical, earlier version of historical materialism. But with this constant process of overcoming his own theoretical difficulties, he tried to learn more about ecology, sustainable metabolic interaction with nature. But he also learned different ways of interacting with nature in different modes of production in Russia, in the United States, indigenous people, and so on. He came to endorse that, okay, not necessarily with this kind of dream technologies, we can have much more equal and sustainable kind of mode of production. And this is, I think, what Marx in the end would have called degrowth communism, because his last vision of communism is something radically different from what we usually associate with historical materialism. And this is something also what we really need to learn, because I think Marxism can learn a lot from degrowth people and the recent discussion about sustainability and so on, but also degrowth people can learn from Marxist tradition, because capitalism is really the root cause of today's climate crisis.
Yeah.
And I think it's necessary to criticize capitalism. We need to have a very critical view of capitalism. And in order to overcome capitalism, simply building eco-village is not enough, right? That's something what we actually know. We need to really reorganize various industrial sectors. And this is a tradition of working class struggle, but also socialism has a lot of debates on how we calculate and plan our social production. And that kind of issues are something quite central in the tradition of socialism. And that's very useful for degrowth. So I think we can mutually learn from each other and enrich our theory. And that's the very important basis for building any revolutionary praxis for post-capitalism today.
Yeah. Now, Marx wasn't just a theorist. He was a revolutionary. And obviously, he was always of the mind that his work, he wanted it to be put into practice. He wanted things to happen to change essentially the world. And you may have been expecting this question, Cohen. I'm sure you get asked this a lot. But how do we put these things into practice when, you know, my opinions aside, for better or worse, we live in a world that's dominated by neoliberal consumer capitalist powers. You know, liberalism was all about, when all else fails, you know, a liberal will always fall back on the philosophical ideas of individual rights, consumer rights, these sorts of things. And then even if you can get past that, which I believe you can, they have the military. The system does not allow itself to be changed just through philosophy, logic, and reason. And yet, you know, as your book states, we are currently exceeding six of nine planetary boundaries. So we are in deep shit here. So Kohei, listen, you must be thinking about this day and night. You know, you must have ideas about a future book coming up. Are you a type of person that is ready for the question of how to implement degrowth communism?
Yes, yes. I think, you know, philosophers are often staying in the ivory tower and they are very
it's not even far phased, away from it's not even phased.
That's often the case. But I think philosophers can be useful because often we still have a very capitalist way of thinking. Our common sense is basically dominated by capitalist value standards, right? So I think when we associate, for example, the concept of abundance, we often think about having more money, having bigger real estate, and, you know, having a lot of things, like a commodity. So for us, abundance is something associated with money. But actually, we have to redefine it because I think abundance can mean different kinds of things. For example, in my book, I argue for a radical abundance of communal luxury. Because, for example, we can share public transportation, we can decommodify medical services, we can decommodify education, we can also try to have some kind of free internet and so on. And these are the things that do not necessarily produce the higher ecological impact, but that can be accessible to everyone. Accessible to everyone is a fundamental condition of abundance, right? So abundance of information, abundance of public transportation, abundance of care. And these are the things what we actually need. It's not abundance of private jets. It's not abundance of SUVs. I think so one of the ways we have to first change those basic concepts. Otherwise, when we talk about we need a better life for working class, then we immediately think we need more higher salary for the sake of buying more things and buying bigger cars. They are not ecologically sustainable anyway. So no, I think when we have to think about something better for working class, we can, for example, think about shortening working hours instead of simply talking about higher wages. But often even the unionists are trapped in those capitalist values. So they often only talk about higher wages, more money, better, of course, in capitalism. But we can also talk about a society where we have more abundance of free time. Maybe that's more important, right? So I think these are the things that can be implemented within capitalism: free education, free medical care, free internet. And these are already partially installed in the Western welfare state, but we can also shorten working hours, and we can also create more equal society by imposing higher taxes on certain luxurious items. We can even try to ban private jets and so on. And these are the things that we can totally implement within capitalism, but they will have revolutionary impact, what we call like a non-reformist reform, can be achieved within capitalism because they are non-reformist, because they directly challenge our conceptions of abundance, our dependence on money and commodity, and our way of behavior, because we are so dependent on money. So we work too many hours, and then we end up producing too many things, and then we also waste energy and resources.
Yeah.
So that vicious kind of circle must be sort of abolished, or at least reduced. And I think this is something that we can really organize together with environmentalists. So this is a new alliance of red and green that can be both economically just as well as environmentally sustainable.
Because as you write in Marx and the Anthropocene, that abundance is not a technological threshold, but a social relationship to what your point is. So like, we're not waiting for AI or the Star Trek replicator to come along to, you know, make abundance a thing. It's just a choice we have to make with ourselves to do this.
Exactly, because when we think about abundance with AI or some kind of zero marginal costs, Paul Mason talks about that kind of post-capitalist abundance. Yeah. It's actually not that radical in a sense that we simply impose our capitalist value without some kind of limitation to capitalists. Like everyone, every worker becomes some kind of capitalist. But the problem is the earth is finite. That means we have planetary boundaries and resources are also finite in a sense. We really need to have a more radical conception of affluence, radical conception of free time, happiness, well-being. There are a lot of things to do. Otherwise, we will simply repeat the kind of colonizing, imperialist way of living in the future. So that's not green. That's not just. So I think, but however, the problem is many Marxist or left-wing people still trapped in that kind of myth of further development, especially those people in the global north, because it's easier, you know, if technology solves all those problems, we don't have to really change our way of life. But I think it's no longer possible. I think it's also not good to continue this way because we work too many hours. We often sacrifice so many things and we should focus more on our well-being, free time, and justice, and equality.
Like as we're talking kind of about solutions and the path forward, I'm interested to know if like you're having conversations with like politicians and socialists, actors in Japan about your work, and like what is the reception from the people that, you know, look to do this through an electoral process in Japan?
Yeah. So I think it's very interesting that even the Prime Minister Kishida read my book, and during the pandemic he really criticized the neoliberalism, you know, the LDP, the Liberal Democratic Party in power, sort of introduced neoliberal reforms in the last 20 years, but that only enlarged inequality and so on. So he actually advocated for new capitalism. But, you know,
of course,
his vision was, after all, and, you know, about the more digitalization, AI, and the kind of green growth and so on. So he, of course, didn't go far enough to endorse some kind of socialism or whatsoever. But there are many discussions on the limitation of capitalism, especially because Japan is suffering from the recession for long stagnation for 30 years. And many young people actually do not have any optimistic vision of the future of Japan, because the number of the population is also starting to decrease and so on. So in the sense that people are more open to different kind of vision, I think this is a very great chance, opportunity for the leftist intervention. But the problem is the left is still trapped in the kind of the reviving or stimulating economic growth in Japan so that all the workers can have higher wages and so on. Of course, higher wages is better than lower wages. But but the problem is whether it's really possible, right? We have tried so many things in the last 30 years and the growth does not happen, then maybe we should also plan for some worst cases where the economy doesn't grow, so we have to deal with something. And then I think degrowth is a first recognition of that difficulty of economic growth. And then after recognizing this limit, we will think about how we can actually use this crisis as a new opportunity to have better more equal society. And then it's interesting in Japan that, yeah, not only politicians, but also people working in the big corporations actually listen to me. And today, yesterday, I was on TV, actually. And, you know, those kind of reception is starting to take place in Japan. And I think it will, of course, spread more in the coming years, because the crisis that we are witnessing will not go away in any way. So it will only get worse as long as we continue today's business as usual. So I think we really have to update our conception so that we can really intervene in the today's situation in a more critical manner.
Totally, totally.
Yeah. Kohei, we won't keep you much longer, mate, but with this, you said something that I thought was really interesting. It was about how when you advocate for certain changes, those almost like those material conditions allow people to experience a new way of living and then almost a new way of thinking, and they'll want another sort of, oh, we'll go down this path. And I really think that's really, I often watch debates between sort of socialists and communists and people who are classed as progressives or liberals. And I think a big thing that the reason why they talk past each other is because, you know, a socialist, a communist does believe that material conditions is what creates the way that we think, the way that we live, and our cultures and our social ways of interacting. Whereas a liberal will almost flip it around and say, no, it's the consciousness, it's the person who creates the material conditions. And often I think they're sort of talking past each other. So I really advocate that sort of way of thinking where, you know, you advocate something that is social. And once people absorb that policy or absorb that way of living, it will then, just through the material conditions, allow them to view another way of doing something and then maybe go down that path. So I thought that was really interesting. Just in regards to the next steps that we were talking about. So obviously, community is very important when it comes to action, right? So there'll be people listening to this now, Kohei, and they'll be saying, yes, I want to do more. I believe I'm an eco-socialist. I want to do this. What would you say that people should do like tomorrow? You know, is there a group that you advocate for on a universal level? Should people, like, where do people put this energy before it dissipates and becomes a forgotten podcast? Like, you know, what do you advocate people to physically do like tomorrow, Kohei? Where should they go? Who should they speak to? What should they read? Who should they contact? How can they begin the journey to a new way of living?
Yeah, in Japan, the problem is there are not many social movements, environmental movements, and so it's even like really hard for many people to imagine that they can actually make some kind of a difference in society. So I often use this number, 3.5%. It's a famous number from Erica Chenoweth. And, you know, some leftists are critical of this theory, but basically she says that when 3.5% of people seriously stand up for some kind of change society in a non-violent manner and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And this message is to... No, you know, not necessarily... This message is not... This theory is not necessarily applicable to the climate crisis, because climate crisis really have the transformation of entire social infrastructure and the economic system. It's not like one dictatorship is go away and then everything changes and so on. So it's maybe not appropriate to use this number in terms of climate crisis, but at the same time, I want to emphasize that often under capitalism, when people hear about a climate crisis and they feel like doing something good, they often end up doing some kind of eco-conscious consumption, like buying electric vehicles. And then they believe that, oh, I did something good for the environment, and they stop doing things. I think it's very important to talk to other people and engage with them, because consumption is an individual choice. It doesn't change society. But if you recognize the problem, I think it's very important to communicate with your friends or colleagues or even like families to start some kind of discussion, and they, you know, together try to find a solution. And this is a beginning of creating this 3.5%. And I think it's hard. It's very hard indeed to change the social infrastructure. It takes many, many years, like 30, 40 years. That's why we have to act now. But my experience in the last 5 years or so, the ideas, our ideas actually change quite rapidly. For example, today, degrowth is spreading Europe. I didn't myself accept the idea of degrowth 5 years ago, but now I'm fully convinced. The same can be true in terms of gender equality, and it can be said to other kind of Black Lives Matter and so on. Our conception, our value standard can rapidly change over one night even, after a certain experience. So maybe this conversation with someone else after you recognize this problem of climate crisis and you talk to someone else, and for them, that will be the moment of change. So I think the value can actually quite quickly change. This is not the idealist way. It's a very material, because our planet is in crisis. There's a material condition that compelled us to change our consciousness. And then, so I think we can quite, there's a potential that in the next 10 years or so, degrowth becomes some kind of a new normativity. It's not yet today. It's not politically attractive for many people, but in the last 5 years, it's been changing a lot. And I think it will accelerate in the next 10 years. And then I think it's really possible in the 30, 40 years, we will start making a kind of transition to a more sustainable society. So I think it's still very important to read philosophers like Karl Marx, because I think he really challenges us to change what we take for granted under capitalism. And so this is a very important to have this kind of discussion on Marxism, degrowth, and communism, especially if we are in the middle of a crisis. Some people say, no, we should focus on more concrete policies and so on. But I think we need to have big, bold ideas precisely because we are in a very serious crisis.
That we are. Kohei, you've been a fantastic guest, mate. Thank you so much for your time. And we wish you well for the future. And I'm looking forward to any work that you are thinking about. I'm sure you are at the moment, and potentially get you on in the future to discuss that. But thank you so much for today. Okay, guys, this is part of the show that you are familiar with, where we give a bit of a shine, a bit of a shout out for people that are doing their bit for all of us on this planet of ours. Kohei, who have you got this week, mate?
Yeah, I want to thank my children, Risto and Lisa.
Wonderful.
Yeah, they are still young. They are 7 and 4 year old. You know, they don't really know about climate crisis, but, you know, they really compel me to think about better future and act for it, because it's really important for my generation to stop the climate crisis, because it is only our generation that makes this decision. If we don't do anything, our ecological impact will last thousands and ten thousands of years. So I think really after having a family, I really think more seriously about the future. And they give me hope. They are, you know, looking forward to new society, and I want to grow up with them.
Of course, that's lovely, that's mate. Great. Thank you for that. And a big thank you to everyone that is listening. And remember, if you're helping the planet in any way at all, no matter how big or how small, we love you, we appreciate you, and we hope you join us again next time. Take care, everyone.
Bye.
We'd like to say a massive thank you to all of our supporters on Patreon, and a special shout out to our top tier patrons, Barbara Burke, Yermund, Jill Burke, Jolyn Stone, Karen Taylor, Lizzie, Marie-Louise O'Hanrahan, and Steve Smith. Thank you so much for your support. If you'd like to join these amazing people and support the show, head to patreon.com/GNDMediaUK. And if you can't afford to help us out, please leave us a review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. Thank you so much.